Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. June 19th marked the 70th anniversary since former Wyoming Governor and U.S. Senator Lester Hunt died by suicide in his office in D.C. Hunt served in Washington during the peak of McCarthyism, and he himself was targeted politically by McCarthy's cronies. For many years, details of the political pressures exerted over Hunt were hidden or underreported. Today, we're playing our recent live panel discussion that includes historians, a current state lawmaker, and a mental health expert to talk about Lester Hunt's life and legacy.
I see so many parallels between 1954 and that era and the era that we have now. And I think there's hope in the story when you figure out what comes next.
That discussion is coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome back to Open Spaces. Today, we're playing our recent live panel discussion about the life and legacy of former Wyoming Governor and U.S. Senator Lester Hunt.
I want to thank everyone for coming today, and I'm especially grateful to our panelists for sharing their time and their expertise, too. I'm Nikki Ouellette. I'm the managing editor here at Wyoming Public Radio. Our panel today includes Roger McDaniel. He's a former state lawmaker and author of the book Dying for Joe McCarthy's Sins, The Suicide of Wyoming Senator Lester Hunt. We also have Andy Somerville. She's the executive director of the Wyoming Association of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Centers. We have Senator Cale Case. He is a current lawmaker representing Senate District 25. And Leslie Wagoner, the Simpson archivist at the American Heritage Center. The American Heritage Center holds a collection of Hunt's papers and his letters. And Leslie has very graciously prepared some slides for us about Hunt's early life and his later political career. Just a quick note before we dive in today, we are going to be talking about some topics that might be difficult for some listeners and viewers. If you or someone you know needs help or just needs to talk to someone, you can call or text the National Crisis Hotline at 988. Talking often helps. And we'll hear more about 988 a little bit later. Leslie, if you want to share your screen, I'd love for you to take it away.
Great. Thanks, Nikki. Thanks for letting me be part of this discussion. And this is a very, very short overview, kind of to give some context to Lester Hunt's life before we dive into further conversation. So Lester Hunt was born in 1892 in Isabel, Illinois, and his journey to Wyoming began in a very unusual place, a baseball diamond. He was quite the pitcher, and it led to him being recruited for Landers baseball team in 1911. He put down roots in Lander, and he started a dental practice in 1917, married, began a family with wife Nathel, and had two children, Elise and Lester Hunt Jr., known as Buddy. By 1934, though, he was having such pain in his legs that he was having trouble standing by the dental chair. This was because he had given bone grafts to Buddy to treat Buddy's bone cysts. And so this health setback, he had no clue, my guess is, that this would lead to a prominent life on the political stage. So Hunt, he went on to dedicate himself for the rest of his life to public service. He worked as a Democrat in the state legislature. He became Wyoming Secretary of State. That if you're from Wyoming and you have the bucking horse and rider on your license plate, Lester Hunt, as Secretary of State, commissioned that design. And it's been on our license plate since 1936. He next became a very popular two-term governor, the first two-term governor. And remember, he's a Democrat in a traditionally Republican state. And his mettle was tested. It was a Republican majority in both the House and the Senate while he was governor, but he handled the situation quite adeptly. Hunt's popularity in the state was rising high. And after he gave it much consideration, he decided to run for the U.S. Senate while he was still governor. He won, in 1948 and began his term in 1949. And this popularity followed him into the Senate. For example, he served on a special committee in the Senate that was investigating organized crime. And the committee chair, Estes Kefauver, was so impressed with Hunt that Kefauver asked Hunt to be his vice presidential running mate should he win the 1952 Democratic nomination. Kefauver did not win the nomination, but it's just one example showing how well he was thought of by his Senate colleagues. But there was one Senate colleague with whom he did not get along well, and that was another rising star, Senator Joseph McCarthy. So when Hunt arrived in the Senate in 1949, McCarthy was on the cusp of what would become a very notorious anti-communism campaign. Although Hunt was no fan of communism, he became disgusted with McCarthy and his tactics, calling them unscrupulous, among other opinions. And those opinions were shared by others, but few dared say them out loud. And in fact, Hunt went on to introduce legislation that allowed private citizens to sue members of Congress who libeled them. And this was a direct attack on McCarthy and his allies. Unfortunately, that legislation didn't pass, but it showed the Hunt's courageous stance when many others would just bow down to the current pressure of McCarthy and his allies. So this conflict came to a head in 1953 in June, when Hunt's son, Buddy, was arrested for soliciting sex from an undercover male, undercover officer. McCarthy's powerful ally, Senator Stiles Bridges, saw an opportunity once he heard about this arrest. Although charges against Buddy were dismissed, Bridges and another ally of McCarthy, Senator Herman Welker, made sure Buddy was prosecuted. And they then threatened Senator Hunt that if he did not resign, if he sought re-election, they would publicize this incident with Buddy. And then they escalated the threat when Hunt resisted by saying they were going to blanket Wyoming with flyers about the situation. So revenge certainly played a role in what they were doing to Hunt, but there was also a very slim Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate. And they knew, as did Lester Hunt, that if he left, it was a shoo-in that a Republican would be appointed to take his place, as the Wyoming governor was a Republican. So Hunt's correspondence at the American Heritage Center showed this inner struggle he was facing as he contemplated what to do, contemplated his choices. He has optimism that McCarthy's popularity was declining. He talks about his own chances for a re-election in 1954. There's a health issue he's dealing with. His wife's going through agony because of the family's situation. And then ultimately, he writes that he cannot continue in this re-election bid in 1954. And I don't know how well you can see the excerpts, but in April and May, he is, yes, I'm going to run. He's looking at poll numbers. By June 4th, he says, I cannot do this. So finally, what transpired during this period that led up to his suicide on June 19th, 1954? I mean, what a drastic choice to make. And so I just say, with this context in mind, I'd like to turn to the panel discussion and discuss this situation and explore any parallels that we can see in today's political climate.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for putting that together.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Today, we're playing our recent panel discussion about the parallels between our lifetime and the lifetime of former Wyoming Governor and U.S. Senator Lester Hunt.
I would like to bring us back into the 1940s and 50s for a moment. This is the peak of Hunt's political career. And as Leslie said, anti-communist sentiment was on the rise, hitting a boiling point. And it was a divisive time in other ways as well. Roger, in your book, you have a chapter called The Age of Suspicion. Can you talk a bit about what that means and what living through that era was like?
Well, Hunt went to the Senate in the post-World War II era at a time when it was becoming increasingly clear that the U.S. and its allies would be in conflict with the Soviet Union. And that's sort of the backdrop for that creates McCarthyism and his claim that there were a lot of communists in the government, that Stalin was recruiting spies, particularly among homosexuals. And so there was sort of this level of fear that that created in the wake of this horrible world war that brought Americans really into a lot of strife and a lot of conflict, not unlike what we're seeing today.
Senator Case, I want to bring you in at this moment. It's fair to say that politicians did, and even before then and still now, have run dirty campaigns. But I'm hoping maybe you can put this into context for us. You know, this blackmail attempt of exposing Hunt's son's arrest, how was that seen politically then?
Well, certainly we have to try to put ourselves back in that time. And one thing to remember is homosexuality was illegal. There were crimes against it. You know, it seems kind of crazy now, but you know, people, I think politicians have probably always tried to use dirt on other people, but in good times, I think there's a certain standard, you know, that should apply. And there was no standard whatsoever in the behavior of Senator McCarthy and his two cronies that were instrumental in this. It came out of an era of fear. People were scared. The Red Scare was real. And but as far as the politics go, it's amazing what goes up and what comes down. When Hunt was first elected Secretary of State in Wyoming, all five elected officials were Democrats for the first time in history. And that was an amazing thing. And you have to remember that was during the Roosevelt and fighting the Depression. And then we went to wartime footing, and the Democrats maintained quite a hold. And it wasn't until in 48 that the Republicans started to make inroads again. And then Eisenhower won very big in 1952. But things were so dirty at that time that Senator Joseph McCarthy actually came to my county, Fremont County, and he held a rally in support of getting then Governor Barrett elected to the other U.S. Senate seat that was up for election that year. And he won that election. The governor won that election, beat O'Mahony. So, and there was this rally in a very rural part of Fremont County. And according to the press reports, it was attended by 3,500 people, which is an astounding number for anywhere in rural Wyoming, I think. It was at Diversion Dam, if anybody knows where that is. It's on the Wind River as part of the reservation. But McCarthy stood there and akined the Democratic Party to the commiecrats. He used that term, and he also talked about hunting communists like you hunt skunks, and he'd hunted skunks as a boy, and sometimes you get stink on you, but you gotta hunt skunks. And he shouted out to the crowd, "Do you want me to still hunt communists and skunks?" And 3,500 people shouted, "Yes, yes," they were all for it. And that was when things were starting to change. I'm convinced that they came here for that rally just to stick it to Senator Hunt a little bit. So this was just like signs of time, very hardball politics. We do see it now today, but it ebbs and flows. And I'm hoping that we can get it to ebb again, because I see the parallels today with the nastiness, the bombastedness. I don't even know if that's the right word, but the way that people can make appeals without facts and just keep repeating lies over and over again, and yet be very popular and win elections because of it. I think we see some of that now. Definitely saw it then. But the lesson here is that after these events with Senator Hunt, and interestingly enough, just 10 days before his suicide was the Army McCarthy hearings, when the civilian attorney for the Army uttered the words on TV, "Have you no decency, sir?" And that these things were televised for the first time. The time was tide was changing. By that fall, McCarthy was censored by his colleagues in the United States Senate. I just see tons of lessons in this. And I've wanted to bring attention to this 70th anniversary because I see so many parallels between 1954 and that era and the era that we have now. And I think there's hope in the story when you figure out what comes next. I hope that we can use this opportunity in Wyoming to really bring attention to our astounding problem with suicide and the fact that it is something that we can do so much about and makes such a difference. Because with suicide, all people really need is one person to help.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Today, we're playing our recent panel discussion about the parallels between our lifetime and the lifetime of former Wyoming Governor and U.S. Senator Lester Hunt.
I found this quote from a correspondent at the New York Times named Alan Drury, who described Hunt when he first came to D.C. as, quote, 60-ish, dumpy, always smiling, always humorous, outwardly serene, but obviously a host to hidden demons, end quote. Andy Somerville, I would love to bring you in. And I'd like to hear more about that phrase, hidden demons. How did Americans understand mental health or moments of acute emotional distress during this time in the middle of the 20th century? And what kind of resources were available for people who were struggling?
Well, that, Nikki, that's a really great question. Mental health in the United States has been something of a slow comer to the field of healthcare. For sure. So if you think back to that time, Congress didn't even really have their first conversation about anything related to mental health or suicide until the very late 50s. I believe it was 58 or 59. And they didn't even begin to recognize that it was an issue until the mid 60s. And so you think back to that time and the culture and just everything that was happening. Somebody that was struggling with a mental illness or having suicidal thoughts, that wasn't something that they really had resources to go to. There wasn't anywhere to go. It was something that would, you know, they kept internally. They didn't talk about it. It was shameful. And that really, that's reflective. And frankly, it's still something we struggle with today, that legacy in terms of suicide and seeking help for mental health issues. Continues on today. We've made some serious strides, but it really took Congress and the United States in general a long time to move forward. So Congress started with some small research funding and working with, I believe it was the National Institute of Mental Health back in the day, to move things. But if you took almost 40 years from when they started that conversation before they had a conversation about having a suicide hotline, just providing that basic of a resource in the United States. Congress didn't provide that funding until 2001. And what we know today is 988, which when it was stood up, was the National Suicide Hotline, didn't actually open its doors until 2005. And so that really frames for me that perspective on, wow, that took a really long time. We're still in our late infancy in starting to develop and really get ahead of those resources. So somebody like Senator Hunt really didn't have anywhere to go to. You really relied on a friend or a family member that you could talk to if you were willing to have that conversation with somebody, which again, most people were, they really kept it inside and kept it internal. And I think that's reflective in the data that you look at. It's a little scary to think that it was really not uncommon back then for families to, if somebody died by suicide, to try to hide that fact. Nobody wanted that fact to be known. It wasn't you know, it just wasn't something that they wanted to discuss. Again, that feeling of shame of having those thoughts or having a family member that was going through that were very significant.
You know, I think a tell in Senator Hunt's situation, and it's a big tell for people, his own brother had died by suicide in the same violent manner 2 years earlier. And, you know, that to me, and I know that this is why the discussion about suicide really, really matters, and that people need to understand that they always think they're making the world better off. And the truth is, it's a tragic devastation that people, families are wiped out, friends are wiped out, and it tends to repeat. And so that's why we need to really focus and use this event to address the issue of suicide in Wyoming.
And Senator Case, to that point, that the idea that suicide affects one person, that they're making the world a better place, is one of the biggest fallacies that continues to remain. A death by suicide affects the family members, as so evidenced by this case. It really impacts community members. We continue to learn more about that, but I don't think that was really recognized for a very, very long time, those are true ripple effects. There's something in the mental health world that we call clusters. So unfortunately, to this day, when we see one death by suicide, we tend to see clusters sometimes where all of a sudden we've had no deaths by suicide, and now we've got three, we've got four, we've got six over a 6 or 12 month period. And that's something that needs to be talked about, as well as people that suicide has no demographic. Suicidal thoughts doesn't matter what your race or your ethnicity is. It doesn't matter how much money you make, where you live, where you came from. It has no demographic. And we know now, way better than we did way back then, that middle-aged men and older men and older adults, to a large extent, are largely impacted in Wyoming. They're our most high-risk group as of today. And again, you know, the question becomes, do we spend enough time talking about that?
You know, when I first met his son, Buddy, kind of a funny story. I get a Facebook friend request one day from Lester C. Hunt Jr. And I write a column for the newspaper, and a mutual friend had shared some columns that I had written, and he wanted to talk to me. So we visited, and I said, somebody ought to write your father's biography. And he said, well, how about you doing that? And I said, well, I'll give that some thought. And he invited me to Chicago to visit with him. So I went out for a week. Wonderful, wonderful human being. Very delightful. By then, he'd been married for 40 years and had two daughters and had grandchildren. But I asked him how he dealt with his father's suicide. And he said, years of psychological therapy. And I said, why? And he said, well, it was my fault. What I did caused my father to kill himself. He did not know of the blackmail. In fact, he didn't understand how it would be possible to blackmail somebody with information that had been in the newspapers. But when I looked at the research in the book and looked at all of the newspapers in Wyoming during that time period, I think it appeared in only two newspapers. Rollins ran the Drew Pearson column that exposed the whole blackmail. And I think it was the Torrington newspaper on about page 16 had a little story that said, Washington, D.C. man convicted of morals charge. So people in Wyoming didn't know about it, and the blackmail could be useful. But Buddy was convinced, he spent much of his life convinced that his father killed himself because of what he had done, which was some justice that he got from the book. He called me after he saw the manuscript and said, thank you, now I know what happened. And I didn't realize how much torment they put my father through in that last year of his life. He referred me to the research of Emile Durkheim, who is a 19th century sociologist who is credited with creating the discipline of sociology. And Durkheim's theory wrote a lot about suicide. And his theory boiled down to a belief that when someone commits suicide, it's a symptom of deeper problems in the culture. And when you look at Senator Hunt's suicide, it certainly was the result of deeper problems in the political culture. But when you look at any number of suicides, the suicide rate among LGBTQ youth, or the suicide rate among farmers during difficult financial times, or veterans, it's connected somehow to broken places in the culture. And I found that work very interesting, and I think it has to be part of the discussion here in Wyoming about how do we reduce the suicide rate. What do we do to fix those broken pieces of the culture that cause people to feel the only way out is to take their life?
And Roger, I think that is an immensely important point. The quote, Nikki, that you had earlier about inner demons, we all have to realize that as human beings, you don't know what your neighbor's been through. You haven't walked through their shoes. You don't know the weight that they're carrying. And how we treat people societally on a personal level can have such a tremendous impact and influence. And I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, I've thought about, as we talk about Senator Hunt, what that conversation would have been like in the age of social media. That is one of our big challenges that we have right now with our youth, with our young people, and with the political tenor of the day and how that goes about, right? We've talked about, there wasn't a lot of information, as Roger stated, about what had actually happened with Buddy. Now we live in a day and age where there's all kinds of information, true or not. And it seems a lot easier for people to hide behind the internet when they make comments, and that reflects on how we treat each other. And those types of issues really, really do impact people. One interesting thing about what we see with people that die by suicide, they are not people that are receiving ongoing mental health treatment. They are not people that are suffering from another type of mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. Those usually are not the people that we see. They are the people that are, they call them our silent sufferers, where they are dealing with their internal demons. They are dealing with a perception from the culture that they live in or other issues. And that really manifests in itself in an unfortunate way. And so I think it's just interesting to look at that dynamic between the times and how much pressure Senator Hunt still felt, and what that might look like in today's world with all of the additional tools and social media that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really fabulous. I have been thinking about all this, and I think that when Roger and Buddy connected, that was really a miracle. And Buddy's whole life had to be really amazing, and to overcome all that. And then finally to have Roger explain, especially the part about a publisher in Wyoming named Tracy McCracken, who actively covered the story up and was a Democratic state committee man. And, and he was also an honorary pallbearer at Hunt's funeral. But I just think that's so important. And, I've been trying to reach out to the Hunt family, and I've had no luck. And I know there are people out there that are have this in their descendants, and I think they'd be pleased to know how Wyoming, after 70 years, has finally taken something that was really buried, the demons of homosexuality, of suicide, and I feel like we're finally doing justice here by having all these observations around the state. Anyway, Roger, you've done some great work. You really have.
Well, and a shout out to you, Cale, for creating interest on this 70th anniversary around the state. The story was kept quiet for decades. Because Tracy at the funeral, you talked about people gathered at the funeral. Vice President Nixon was there, 12 or 14 U.S. senators, Tracy McCracken. They're sitting around the conference room at St. Mark's Church waiting to do their duty as pallbearers. And they have this conversation. Everybody knew what happened. And Tracy McCracken, the newspaper publisher, said, "I'm not going to publish this story. It would kill Mrs. Hunt." And Mrs. Hunt fought for years to keep the story from being told, threatened to sue Dr. T.A. Larson when he included the story in his History of Wyoming, because the stigma of homosexuality and the stigma of suicide was so great, she didn't want her son dragged through that again. And so for decades, few people in Wyoming knew the story. I worked on Tino Roncalio's staff when he was a congressman. He had been a close friend of Lester Hunt's, knew the whole story. And when I asked him about Senator Hunt's suicide, all he would say is, "They treated that man very badly." But nobody, that was in the mid-60s and into the 70s, nobody wanted to talk about suicide. As Andy has noted, I do want to make one point that I think we need to cover, and that is what brought it on. Leslie alluded to that, and also Cale to that time frame. For a year, he's subjected to incredible torment. We've talked about some of it, but people broke into their home in Washington, D.C. when they were back in Lander for Christmas and ransacked it, obviously looking for something. If you can imagine the emotional stress of having somebody do that to you, along with these political threats. But the iconic philosopher Albert Camus said, if you want to know why somebody committed suicide, look at the last encounter they had with another human being and what was said that maybe stirred their soul or caused them great anxiety. And that for Lester Hunt was Joe McCarthy. On Friday afternoon, McCarthy announces that he is going to hold a hearing, one of his famous hearings, that resulted in prior suicides and ruined reputations and caused people to lose their jobs and their livelihoods. But he said on Friday, "I'm going to open a hearing on a Senate colleague of mine who was involved in paying a bribe to have charges dismissed." Well, that was what Bridges and Welker had alluded to months earlier when the charges were first dismissed against Buddy Hunt. They said it was because Senator Hunt paid a bribe. Never any evidence of that. But McCarthy is now going to open up hearings. And I think that was the moment when Hunt said, "I'm not doing this anymore. I told him I wouldn't run for re-election. That wasn't enough. They're still out to ruin our family." And so the next morning, he killed himself.
You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Today, we're playing our recent panel discussion about the parallels between our lifetime and the lifetime of former Wyoming Governor and U.S. Senator Lester Hunt.
We're in a moment where states are passing legislation that seems to be targeting minority groups. And I'm just thinking about how it's a difficult moment politically that can drive people to crisis. Andy, I'm eager to hear more about what kind of resources are available. I've heard about the Pickup Man campaign, a more grassroots kind of thing. Can you talk to that and also to the 988 hotline?
Yeah, absolutely. Nikki, we've really seen a lot of movement. I can't think of a better legacy for Senator Hunt than to continue to work on this issue and to help our friends and neighbors. The Pickup Man campaign, we've got a number of our energy companies that are doing their own internal campaigns and stepped up to the plate with their employees, which is really just exciting to see. Our county prevention offices are getting out there and doing more work, trying to work with our minority groups here in the state and make sure that they have access. LGBTQ is important, that it can be very difficult. And they certainly need resources. Our tribal members, we really are trying to work and provide those resources in a culturally important and appropriate way, and in a way where we meet people where they're at. It is so important that it's not just, we'll talk about 988 in a second here, there's not one door or one pathway to help and information. You really need to provide a multitude of ways for somebody to reach out, because you need to meet them where they are. So 988, Wyoming was the last state a couple of years ago to get an in-state call center, and we are so thankful that we've done that. The call centers here, they are busy. They're taking on average more than 500 calls a month right now from Wyoming residents. We believe that number will continue to grow as the FCC finishes and Congress finishes working on changing it from an area code based system to a digital geolocation. So if you're actually in the state, it will go to the state you're actually standing in. That resource, we've brought that online here in Wyoming and trying to reach people where they're at. So 988 provides direct access to the Veterans Crisis Line. There's an LGBTQ specific line for those groups that feel that they want more somebody who understands them better, which is an absolutely fair and appropriate ask and resource to have for those groups. We are in Wyoming just bringing on the text and chat features. So as we talk about, risk groups are younger folks under the age of 25. We are seeing increased suicidal risk in our schools. It was very heartbreaking to hear that about 10% of our middle school and high school students have actively engaged in planning a suicide or have attempted suicide. And so as we reach, we have to figure out how to reach them. And text and chat is where they want to be. And so we're rolling those services out to people. So in Wyoming here, you can call, text, or chat 988. You can walk into an ER. You can walk in or call a community mental health center. There's a variety of private practice and other mental health resources available in every community. But what we really want to get out to everybody is that there is absolutely an option and there's a resource. And one of 988's best features is that it can be anonymous if somebody wants it to be that way. So you can call and ask for help and get resources, or you can be a family member who calls and says, hey, something's going on. I don't know what to do. We want them to go ahead and call 988 and we'll get them connected. And so we're going to continue to work on building out those resources. We're in a much better position as a state than we were 5 years ago. We've fallen down the state rankings a little bit in Wyoming, which we are, it sounds almost macabre to be excited about that, but we are. Wyoming has been number one in suicide per capita for so long. Looks like we've fallen down to number three from the last year. And I think that that is evidenced by the ongoing efforts that are going out and the new resources that are there. So again, the message is there's always hope. There's always an option and pick a door. We will meet you whichever way you'd like to come in.
What recommendations might you have for parents, siblings, friends who notice that someone they love is really having a hard time? What can they do?
So I'll kind of break that into two groups. For our kids, or our adolescent and our younger kids, let's say 10 and older population, we know that they talk to each other. They don't necessarily talk to adults. So when something's going on, that's where they're likely to go. And so we want to continue to provide resources to them about what to do when that comes. Basically, an adult needs to be brought into the conversation at some point, a trusted adult. That can be a teacher, a counselor, a parent, an older sibling, whoever that is. And then they can also text and chat, either both Safe to Tell here in Wyoming or 988 is always an option. For parents and adults that know somebody is struggling, 988 is just such a phenomenal resource in the ability to help walk them through what steps can be taken and what might be helpful and how do you get somebody that help. And we want to encourage folks to reach out and have that conversation. In addition, one of the other things that we've been doing across the state for the last couple of years is rolling out through a variety of groups, different types of training. So people that are interested in knowing how to provide more on-scene immediate support, they can go through a training that's just a couple hours long that really provides them the tools on to know how to help somebody, keep them safe, and move them towards services. And the last thing that I would just say is we know that the most important thing is that somebody talks to somebody else. So if you have a friend or a child or a sibling that you know is struggling, take the time and sit down and talk to them. Don't be afraid to have that conversation. Don't be afraid to step into that space, because that conversation may very well save their life.
And Andy, I think I've learned that suicidal thoughts are common, and that many, many people get a little bit of help, just a little bit more assistance at this crisis time, and their lives are better for the rest of their lives. It's not that you're in a cycle of a pattern that you can't ever get out of. No, it's actually it's very recoverable. It really is.
It absolutely is. Everybody at one point in time will struggle with something. Suicidal thoughts can be caused by situation, culture, as we've talked about, financial issues, family issues, job stress. There's so many different things that can really factor into that. And you, Senator Casey, you are absolutely correct. One conversation, just a little bit of help can make all the difference.
Well, there's one other factor that that needs to be discussed too, and that is the research done by the Trevor Project, which is a suicide prevention effort largely aimed at LGBTQ people. And their research shows that when there is a debate in the state legislature about trans people or about gay people or their rights or their dignity, that and last year, more than 500 bills were introduced against anti-LGBTQ community bills. And when those debates occur, it drives up the suicide ideation among that population, and attempts increase. Because I mean, you can imagine that when those debates occur, that people in that community consider it a direct attack, not on just them or their dignity, but their right to exist. And the things that get said about them during those debates are very harmful. And I don't know, Senator, whether some of your colleagues would buy that argument, but the research is out there, and it tracks suicide ideation and attempt rates to those political debates. And that would explain Durkheim's theory, actually.
I just wanted to add a quick note. In 2022, the American Heritage Center sponsored a tour of a play called A Sissy in Wyoming about a man who lived in Douglas who was a cross-dresser, and he suffered a lot of abuse for that. And after each of the performances, we did a nine city tour. We had talkbacks, and I was there for most of them, and just seeing it was many of the LGBTQ plus community in our state, and the pain that I sensed when they didn't feel like they had a safe place to talk, except for there felt some safety in that place. And the stories that we heard, and the stories from parents that we heard of their kids who had been struggling, especially with identity issues and gender issues. It was wow. It was eye-opening to listen to those stories.
I can imagine. A final question I would like to ask all of you. You know, you're pretty up close and personal with the daily ins and outs of state politics and have been for years. How have you found ways to protect your own emotional and mental well-being during these times that can be very polarizing and difficult? And maybe Senator Case, we can begin with you.
Oh, thanks a lot. Politics is pretty hardball business. I've been around long enough that it's easier for me now, because I'm not that worried about getting reelected or what a certain party thinks of me, or I've come to that, and that's provided me peace. But I do know I have colleagues that agonize over this, and very, very good people that won't vote their conscience on the floor of the Wyoming Senate because they feel pressured about the next election and how this will play out and things. And thankfully, I'm past that, and I'm very grateful to that. And I do think that the attacks in politics are very, very harmful. There's a certain dignity and respect for our political process, for democracy, if you will, and the way we interact. Hunt was epitome of that, and that's something I'd like to bring forward. That's why this is about civility. There are other folks that are just incredibly harmed. And Roger, you were in politics too, and you know that politicians' family suffers greatly on the attacks. You know, they take it much harder, actually, I think, than the elected person does sometimes. And it's a hard business. It's a cruel business. I think people are basically in it for the right reasons. They truly, truly are. But so many people now, and it's so easy to just put a terrible email together or a calling tree for phones the night before the election that calls you all sorts of things. Like, there's a group called Honor Wyoming that says I don't have any integrity. And they've got me as a low integrity person on their website. Now, listen, my integrity is my bond, my word. That's not civil. And we're all better than that. And we got to get there. And we got to get that back.
Nikki, I just share, you can't emphasize for all the discussion and debate, and I don't have to stand on the floor of the legislature, but and trying to support everybody, just having people to talk to is so incredibly important. Having friends that kind of trudge through that together. And I think Senator Case's comment about the families is so important. You know, making sure that they feel supported and they have the resources. This is a very hardball business at the moment. And it's a really good opportunity to just take a minute, take a breath and say to everybody, it really matters how we treat each other. I'm reminded that our K-12 school districts do all these kindness matters campaigns, and we try to teach our kids about that stuff. And I wonder if we haven't forgotten that a little bit as adults, and it would be an excellent time to remind people that kindness really does matter. How you treat people matters. You can disagree, and that's fine. But there's a line there. And in the meantime, friends, family, people that you can talk to, just don't take it on and keep it on your shoulders by yourself.
Well, I keep my mind, I think, because I've aged out of, I'm at a point in my life where I'm not asking for votes. I'm not running for office. The legislature can't cut my budget anymore. I write a column for the Cheyenne and the Laramie newspapers every week, and I've been doing that for 13 years. And somebody asked me, do you think you're changing anybody's mind? And I said, no, but it helps me keep my own. It's therapeutic to be able to say what you feel without feeling like you're going to lose a job or lose a vote or lose a friend. And so, at my age, it's maybe a little easier. But I really appreciate Senator Case's work to confront his colleagues with this question of civility and how they treat one another and the things they say. And I noted his resolution that asked them to commit to civility. 10 of his colleagues voted no. So it's a little bit, he's a little bit like Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill, but God bless you for fighting that fight, and you, Andy, for the knowledge and information you bring to the legislature that, you know, they have to weigh it. They may or may not do what you'd like them to do, but they have to weigh it. They hear it and they need to know it. So I think that's how we, by modeling those kinds of truthful relationships with one another, we do help.
I think that's a great note for us to end on. Panelists, thank you so, so much. And let me reintroduce you. Today, we've heard from Roger McDaniel, former state legislator and author of the book, Dying for Joe McCarthy's Sins, The Suicide of Wyoming Senator Lester Hunt. We've also been joined by Andy Somerville, executive director of the Wyoming Association of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Centers. Senator Cale Case, who is a current state lawmaker representing Senate District 25, and Leslie Wagoner, the Simpson Archivist at the American Heritage Center. From Wyoming Public Radio, thank you all so much to our panelists. This has been a really insightful and inspiring conversation. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion about the life and legacy of Lester Hunt, a two-time Wyoming governor and U.S. senator. Our full conversation will be posted on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Thanks for listening.